Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And we have an exciting show for you today. Lots of deep topics to sink your teeth into.
That's right. In Culture Talk, Sandra's going to be interviewing Krista on how to build a framework for Bible difficulties.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Soarenk will be talking with philosopher of science Mark Perez on fallacies and cognitive biases. That's such a good thing to understand when we're in conversation, especially with people from different perspectives.
Yeah, I'm excited to check that one out, mostly because I don't exactly know what that means.
Well, so you're
it's going to be educational. First up, though, is RTB 101. Chris is going to be interviewing philosopher and theologian Ken Samples on the difference between mystery and contradiction.
Let's check it out.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about an exciting question, at least I think it's exciting, is one of our staff scholars, Kenneth Samples. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, Krista.
Glad to have you here and to talk about mystery versus contradiction. And I remember when I was just a wee lad back in seminary, learning about the doctrine of the Trinity. That was terribly confusing for me in the beginning because I just kept thinking, how can God be both one and three? That makes no sense. So I think this is a helpful way of thinking about this. So I'm hoping you can help step us through these differences. So let's start with contradiction. What is a contradiction?
So the law of non-contradiction says that two statements that negate or deny one another cannot both be true. So a contradiction would be Ken Samples is a human being and Ken Samples is not a human being. Those statements negate or deny. They can't both be true at the same time and in the same respect. And all contradictions, true contradictions, are false.
Okay, so a contradiction is a very clear, like, this can't be true at the same time and in the same way as this other statement is true.
Yeah, I use the expression, not both true.
Okay, not both true. Okay.
Yeah.
So when I think about the issue of the, or the question of the contradiction of the Trinity, I'm wondering, is that a contradiction in the technical sense as you've defined it?
Well, the Trinity, of course, is a mystery, and a mystery would be a truth of divine revelation that human beings cannot fully comprehend or exhaustively understand. But technically, the Trinity is not a contradiction. I mean, if we said God is one and not one, three and not three, then we would have the negation. But in Christian councils, in the creeds, in Christian understanding, we affirm that God is one in essence or being, but three in subsistence or personhood. So God is one in a different way than God is three. God is three in a different way than he is one. So there isn't that negation. So the Trinity is very mysterious. We're not fully sure exactly how God pulls this off, but it can be framed in a way that is not a formal contradiction.
So a contradiction might be if I said I believed in one God and three gods, though those two can't both exist. But
because
if I,
you, yes.
Okay. But if I say I believe in one God, but they are in three persons,
right?
Like three who's, that's not a contradiction because those are not the same types of things. Am I on the right track there?
You're absolutely on the right track. We say that there's only one God, one divine being, but that one divine being exists as three persons or three who's. So again, it eludes the contradiction because it's different in a different category, not in the same respect.
So would this also have some carryover into the question of Jesus being like fully God and fully human? Is that a contradiction? What's going on there?
Yeah, now with the incarnation, so God coming in the flesh, the second person of the Trinity taking a human nature, with regard to the incarnation, we have two what's and one who. That is, Jesus is a single person, but he has a divine nature that he shares with the Father and the Spirit, and he has a human nature that he took in the womb of the Virgin Mary. Yet again, the divine nature doesn't divinize the humanity, and the humanity does not drag down the divinity. They don't mix, they don't overlap, they're distinct. Now again, this is a very mysterious truth, but it can be stated in a way that is not a formal logical contradiction.
Okay, so now we've used the word mystery a couple of times already. It's not the Trinity is not a contradiction, it's a mystery. The incarnation is not a contradiction, it's a mystery. So let's unpack this word mystery a little bit more and what that means in the historic Christian faith.
Yeah, a mystery is a truth of divine revelation, but it is a truth that eludes our ability to totally understand it. So this is something God has revealed about himself. And it's not just when we come to the Trinity or the Incarnation, Krista. Everything God reveals about himself is a mystery, mm-hmm. because he's infinite, we're finite. He's eternal, we're temporal. So when we say a mystery, we don't mean something that's confused and wrong. We mean something that eludes our finite capacity to totally comprehend. And yet it is a truth that God's revealed about himself.
That's really helpful, because I'm imagining that when we talk to our non-Christian friends, when we use the word mystery, if we don't use it properly and define it, and I love how you always define your terms, it can kind of sound like an escape hatch, like we're just inserting mystery as a way to get away from really thinking things through, sort of intellectual laziness. But that's not really what we mean. We're talking about that. You know, there's some things we can kind of explain in this temporal realm, but then there's a bit of a recognition that God transcends the temporal realm. He's beyond the temporal realm. So some things can be true of him that don't fit into our kind of three-dimensional space-time continuum.
That's exactly right. I mean, if I could understand God, he would not be much of a God. And so humanity, we are finite, we have limitations, we have boundaries. God is going to reveal himself. Now, things can be mysterious. Some mysterious things are contradictory, but a Christian doctrinal mystery, it can't be fully comprehended, but it is not a formal logical contradiction. So Christian truth goes beyond human reason, but it doesn't do any damage to human reason.
That's a very important distinction. Thank you for unpacking that for us, Ken. And I want to encourage people, if you haven't yet discovered Ken's wonderful blog, Reflections, just go to reasons.org and search for Reflections. Thanks for joining me, Ken. This has been a great conversation. Hopefully it's helped equip some of you to share your faith with more courage and confidence and compassion.
Welcome to Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I am joined today with RTB scholar and theologian Krista Bontrager. Thank you for joining us today, Krista.
It's great to be here.
We are going to be talking about a common question that skeptics would have, and that is, that doesn't the Bible contradict itself? And when we think about questions like that, we know that we have to be prepared to answer such questions. So before we dive into that, let's talk about how we set up a framework to address such challenges.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point, because, you know, sometimes it can feel very overwhelming. Like, how do I come up with answers for every Bible difficulty that there is? There might be hundreds. So my approach to this is really to develop more of a strategy approach. So our first step is to really clearly identify the apparent contradiction. So if someone raises a question about a potential contradiction, I usually just ask them, what example could you give me of this in the Bible, and help them specify, because often what comes forward is they say, well, I can't believe in the Bible because it's filled with contradictions. And so you want to kindly ask them, oh, that's interesting. Can you help me understand more about that? Which one troubles you the most? And see if they can name a specific one. So then you're you're dealing with a specific problem rather than this big, vague, general problem. And then you're going to move into some kind of research. You don't have to know all the answers in that conversation. Hopefully there'll be an opportunity to actually continue the conversation, meet up for coffee again, and that'll give you both some time to research the options and see what, if chances are, this is not the first person who's stumbled into this problem. There's probably some research out there that could help. And then kind of the third step is to ask the question, how has the church historically dealt with this particular issue? Asking the question of history, I think, helps to provide some guardrails or some strong fences. Like, we have freedom between the fences to talk and try on ideas, but we also want to have good fences and strong guardrails so we don't drift outside of historic Christianity.
Yeah, that's a good framework that you're setting up. And I like that you're actually encouraging people to ask questions, because oftentimes when a question is asked of us, we feel like the only thing we are supposed to do is provide an answer and right away. So right. You're encouraging people, no, you know what, ask for a specific contradiction. What contradiction has troubled you? And mm-hmm. then go there. And then, you know what, take time to research. So that's a great, some great tips right there. Can you think of some specific examples, maybe of a contradiction that you've worked through and what that's looked like for you?
Yeah, I think that my fundamental premise and the premise we have at Reasons to Believe is that when we run into those contradictions, it's a problem of interpretation. Either I need to think more deeply or research more about the biblical side of things of what am I not understanding here? Maybe there's a cultural issue that I don't understand. And the other side of that is, well, maybe I need to understand more about the research, you know, the science, if I have a science question. But they're ultimately, because the revelation is from God, that it will be a true revelation. It'll be an accurate revelation. So I come at scripture with that in mind. But even so, I have struggles. The problem of Quirinius is one that troubles me every Christmas. He's mentioned in Luke chapter 2. It says when Jesus was born, that Quirinius was governor of Syria. And in Matthew's gospel, it says that Herod was the king at that time. Well, the problem is that from secular history, those two don't seem to line up, of Quirinius being governor at the same time that Herod was the king. And so that's something that I can't reconcile yet, but I do spend time every Christmas usually looking at it, seeing what was published in the last year, and kind of continuing to work on that.
Yeah, you know what? And that is such a specific difficulty that you are wrestling with. And I love that. I would think that even in sharing that with the skeptic, that would go a long way in showing that you don't just have blind faith that doesn't engage in the Bible and in the history, but that you are actually wrestling with some stuff yourself as well. I think that would be very helpful. So for someone who maybe doesn't have as deep a question as you have, and they're starting to have conversations with skeptics or those who are even within the Christian faith, but they're struggling on their own, what would you recommend, kind of a starting point? How do I even walk away from the conversation and research and then come back? Where do I even go?
Yeah, I love that. And I love your heart for always redirecting us to think about the person who's searching and the person who's struggling. And I love that voice, because it's totally okay to not have all the answers up front. Totally okay. And in fact, it can actually become a blessing, because when you're looking for these answers, like I said before, chances are you're not the first person that has this question. There's probably some people that have looked into this. So then it becomes an opportunity to learn. You can really flip the script and look at it from a positive of, wow, this is actually an opportunity for me to learn more about my faith and to think more deeply about it. And the other tip I might offer is to just ask God to help you on your journey. There's many people that I've talked to in the time that I've worked at Reasons to Believe, and they said, you know, I really got stuck on this particular science faith problem. but God helped me. You know, he sent me somebody who gave me a Hugh Ross book, or he sent me a scientist in my church, and he was able to kind of unhook me from that problem. So ask the Lord. The Lord wants to be a provision for people to help walk with them in their questions.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. Do you have any specific websites or resources that you would point people to? And one that I think we would both agree on is going to reasons.org, especially if you have a question concerning science and faith. But do you have any other
recommendations? For sure. Yeah, reasons.org. If people are struggling with that tension on science and faith, that's the place to go. A great classic is the Handbook of Bible Difficulties by Gleason Archer. It's just a standard work that will help you in a lot of ways. Another great modern classic is When Critics Ask by Dr. Norm Geisler, who is a friend of the ministry. So those are two kind of compilations all in one place that might help get you started.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, Krista. I really hope that our viewers will be encouraged to study these resources and be equipped so that when someone has a question for them, they're ready to have a conversation. It doesn't mean answers necessarily, but to have a conversation. So thank you again so much for that. If you want to hear more from Krista Bontrager, go to reasons.org and search for Krista Bontrager.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here, and welcome to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas and how they relate to the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Mark Perez, and we are going to be investigating and discussing the effect of fallacies and cognitive biases on the scientific enterprise. Mark, it's good to have you here today.
Thanks, Jeff. It's good to be with you.
You know, when we think about science, we think about reason and rationality and evidence and finding the truth. It's kind of surprising to think that there are actually ways that science can be derailed if we don't think well. And that's kind of the topic of fallacies and cognitive biases. So why don't you start off our segment by just kind of explaining what are fallacies and cognitive biases?
Thank you. Yeah, I'll do that. So first of all, a fallacy is a mistake in reasoning that superficially doesn't look like a reasoning mistake. So fallacies have to do with reasoning. And a cognitive bias is a tendency to make errors in judgment or decision in certain conditions. And no one's immune to them. Even the most intelligent and well-educated people can have them, or do have them, actually. it's universal. They're particularly important in science because they can show up anywhere in research or practice, and they have very serious consequences if they're not checked.
So let's kind of step back there. So you said a fallacy is it's a flaw in reasoning that on the surface doesn't look like it's a flaw in reasoning.
Yes.
Kind of flesh that out a little bit more. Maybe give us an example or something that people can relate to there.
Sure. There's an argument called argument fallacy called cherry picking. And it's when you present an argument and you just present the evidence that you choose to substantiate your position. Now, in science, that can occur in a different way. Instead of just being an argument, it can be selecting only the results that are most favorable to your position. And this can show up, interestingly, in reporting things like research results. So if I do 20 experiments, 19 of the experiments don't give me anything that I want to have. But the 20th one comes up, boom, it's confirming my thesis, my hypothesis. Well, you've just eliminated 19 pieces of evidence from the total picture. And that's called cherry picking. Now that has some very particular problems, pernicious problems actually, in science. And there was an interesting study done by a Harvard statistician in which he looked at a large number of medical research studies. And he concluded that statistically, you could not have that many positive results from the studies that came out. In other words, it was pretty obvious that there was some cherry picking going on. So what happens there, it undermines the confidence in the research. So cherry picking is a fallacy and it can be a big problem.
That's kind of striking to me because you're looking at the data, you're actually looking at data that's really there, unless you know that there's data that's missing, you're just not going to know that. It's an interesting fallacy there. So kind of go to the cognitive biases. Those seem less focused on what the data has to say, and what I'm thinking or what I want to be true. Is that correct?
Well, actually, a cognitive bias can be exactly what you want. But let's start with the first one that's well known in science, and that's a confirmation bias. So the confirmation bias, and all biases, by the way, are tendencies. They're not things that absolutely are going to happen every time. But a tendency to see or seek only the important information that confirms your theory, your favorite theory. And so the problem there is it can exclude important evidence that would falsify your theory or harm it. So if it harms your position and you're only looking for the things that are going to confirm your theory, what else are you doing? Well, what else you're doing is you're excluding important information that may be relevant to the research, but you've blinded yourself to it through this confirmation bias.
Yeah, that's again a very interesting phenomenon, especially considering the wealth of data we have about stuff. I mean, it used to be science and even just life in general was kind of data poor. It was tough to get information, but now there's just this abundance of information. It seems like that bias is, we need to be particularly aware of that bias, especially as we're trying to figure out the truth of how creation works, if you will.
Absolutely. There are other fallacies and biases that can affect us as well. One of the interesting fallacies is a faulty analogy. And a faulty analogy in argument is you compare two things that you have that are similar enough that they're very similar, but then you project that there's something more missing and you filter that in. Now, what happens in science, and this is very important, particularly medical research, is that you use analogical reasoning or analogies, for example, in animal studies. Mm-hmm. So in animal studies, the analogy is that a particular system in the human physiology is identical or similar to a physical system in a particular animal. Therefore, if we try a particular kind of therapy, say a cancer therapy, in the animal, then it'll translate to a human. Now that's an analogy. So the problem is that we find that there are faulty analogies there. And some of the statistics are actually quite shocking. So for cancer studies on animals, one study that evaluated them found 92% of the animal studies did not translate to humans. 92%. Now for stroke, there was something else, and that was for cancer. But for stroke, it ended up being somewhere around anywhere between 3 and 1%, maybe less. So what you have there is a big problem with faulty analogies in the comparison between the two animal physiologies and the humans and the animal and how much similarity there really is. And when you get those kinds of results, what it shows is that the analogy is faulty and that you need to go back in and see what's different. At those kinds of rates, you really need to do some more basic research.
So that raises a question to me, and I'll throw it at you and see if this is an accurate way. You know, one of the arguments I've also often heard is, we're talking about the evolution creation debate, if you will, and there's an aspect of how something works that we don't know, and there's kind of this, well, science will find the answer to that, or evolution will explain that. It seems to me that's kind of drawing on, well, science has found lots of answers, and so we assume it will find every answer in the past. Would that be that sort of fallacy, or is that just something different that's going on?
Well, that's actually very similar. It's called wishful thinking. It's actually the fallacy name for that. Hmm. And that is the belief that the future resembles the past in ways that you can't prove. So merely because scientific enterprise has succeeded remarkably in the past to solve problems that seem to be intractable, you have to remember that there are problems in the past that seem to be intractable that actually were. And so merely because some of them get solved doesn't mean all of them will. And if you're going to say that we're going to have faith that in the future this is going to occur, you have to have some reason to believe that. Right. And so it's a pretty bald claim to say, or wishful thinking, to say that we have these really, really tough things that we have to get over. And we will definitely get over them when you have no way of proving that you have the means or mechanisms to do that.
So it sounds like, pretty clear here that cognitive biases and fallacies kind of wreak havoc on the integrity of the scientific process. So how do we go about dealing with or responding to or rooting them out, if you will? What's the best approach to getting rid of them so that we can actually get to the truth of the matter?
Well, there's no way to get rid of them. So that's the downside. The upside is that the more we know about them, the easier it is to identify them. And when it comes to tendencies, we have to look at when those tendencies arise. So if we're doing research, for example, the tendency towards a confirmation bias is one of those conditions where you're going to find it. So what do we do? How do we reverse that or at least mitigate it? Well, the one thing to do is to ask yourself, what information am I not looking at? The researcher who does that is going to have a really great time avoiding that confirmation bias.
So it seems like it just requires not only assessing the data that's out there, but also kind of reflecting on your state of mind and your tendencies and bias and making sure you're being accurate and getting all the information as well.
Yes, it's slowing down your thinking, starting to look back on what could happen and go wrong, and then reversing that before you get going, particularly in confirmation biases, analogies, those kinds of things. They're actually easy to reverse, but you have to slow down, stop, and realize they're there, and then pay attention to them so they don't occur.
Actually sounds like good biblical advice. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate your comments.
My pleasure.
You know, when we want to do science, it is really important that we actually get to measuring what's going on against the real world. And when we have fallacious reasoning or cognitive biases, that gets in the way of getting to the truth. And it's just incredibly important to identify and root out these fallacies so that we can get to the truth. You know, Mark has written a lot about this in the new book that's come out. It's called Thinking About Evolution. Would you encourage you to go to reasons.org/2819, find out about the book and get your copy today so you'll be prepared to root out these wrong ways of reasoning so that you can be more confident in spreading the truth.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And we hope, like Brian, you have learned about fallacies and cognitive bias.
That's right. I have a starting point now. So
yeah.
Time to dig deeper, though.
True. You can find us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show. And we'd love to hear what you're learning from the show.
And if you like the podcast version, you can get it on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.